This is Teaching for Student Success. I'm Stephen Robineau. In episode 6, Ungrading, Renaissance Humanism and the Challenges of Assessment, we talked with Susan Bloom, editor of the book, Ungrading, Why Rating Students Undermines Learning and What to Do Instead. Dr. Bloom introduced us, well, at least me, to ungrading as a call to arms to motivate student learning by changing the way students are evaluated. In episode 13, Stress, Grades, and the American Way, Time for a Reboot, we talked with Dr. Josh Eiler about the stress students experience and the role grades play in that stress, and how ungrading might be used to reduce student stress while simultaneously improving student learning. Perhaps you've heard of ungrading and dismissed it, or thought about it but decided it wasn't the right time, or decided it wasn't for you or your students, or thought the whole idea was insane, or perhaps you don't know anything about ungrading at all. Perhaps this is the first time you've even heard the term. Whatever your prior knowledge is or isn't about ungrading, please listen. In this episode, we have a conversation with a Teaching for Student Success listener about how, after listening to episodes 6 and 13 and reading the book Ungrading, how this faculty member climbed to the top of the high dive and took a big leap into the pool of ungrading. This is her story and maybe the story about her students. I'm excited to welcome Dr. Sue Steiner, professor in the School of Social Work at the Chico campus of the California State University, known as Chico State. Sue has been teaching for 30 years and has published, among other areas, in the area of teaching effectiveness, particularly in the value or lack of value of the student evaluations of teaching, which I've talked about a number of times on the show. Dr. Steiner's primary interests currently, both in teaching and research, are in community building and community organizing, social welfare policy, poverty, and housing. Sue puts her research and interests into practice. She has started a number of nonprofits in the California North State to address issues of housing, health, and poverty. Welcome, Sue. Thank you for joining us on Teaching for Student Success.
Thanks, Steve. Happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here, and thanks for coming to the podcast. So you listened to our ungrading episodes with Susan and Josh. You read the book by Susan Bloom and decided to test out some form of ungrading with your students. Can you talk about that? What was it about ungrading that struck you or appealed to you?
You know, I've struggled with grading since the very first class that I taught. Assignments were generally papers, not tests, and grading felt really subjective to me. I couldn't really figure out whether or how much to grade on writing versus content. And in both areas, I knew that students came in with dramatically different knowledge and skills. Most of the difference was based on things outside of their control, like our unequal K-12 education system. I knew that also that some students had a lot of time to work on school things because they didn't have kids, they didn't have other family responsibilities, they didn't have to work to fund their education. And it was harder for them to get their schoolwork done. And so to have the same expectation for students, knowing that they had skill and knowledge that was unequal coming in and that they had different responsibilities in their lives. Also, some of them struggled with coursework more because English was not their first language, because they had they learn in different ways, what some people call learning disabilities. I struggle with that concept. But we learn differently, and so the way that we teach is difficult for some students. So grading never felt particularly fair to me. And over the years, I tried a whole variety of different approaches to changing how I graded. You know, for example, I tried things like, I got rid of tests years ago. First, I got rid of time tests because time tests make no sense to me. And then I got rid of tests in general. And then I shifted my practice to having early draft assignments not be graded so they could do some work and then see if they could improve by the end of the semester. And then I was grading just end products. And all of that helped a little bit. I felt less bad about grading, but it never felt right and it never felt fair to me. For some reason, listening to both of those podcasts, particularly the first one on ungrading, really got me thinking about maybe there is no way to fix how I grade and to do it fairly. And it really shoved me to think about, do I just want to get rid of grades? The thing that poked at me the most, I think I've known for years that it wasn't students' fault that they came in at different levels. It's because of how unequal we are as a society based on class and race and gender and disability. So I think I knew that at some level, but hearing Dr. Bloom discuss it on the podcast, that we reinforce that oppression when we continue that process, just spoke to me in such a clear way. And when I know that something I'm doing reinforces sexism and white supremacy and all these other pieces, when I continue to do it, even though I know that that's what it's doing, that's unethical to me. And I couldn't cross that line anymore. So I just decided I needed to stop grading, period. Yeah, I gave it a try.
Wow. There's so much in there. Well, I just love the way you started by talking about the inequity of that students bring to the table, right? As a result of the society that we live in, right? So you just opened this huge, complex box that so many people don't even think about. I saw something on Twitter the other day. I freaking hate Twitter, and I'm actually leaving it. We have it for the podcast, but I'm going to something else. And somebody made a comment about, don't you think the difference in grades has all to do with how much time students spend outside of class thinking about the topic? And I responded and said, oh, well, maybe they're thinking about where they're getting their next meal from or whether they have a roof over their head or not. The lack of sensitivity to understanding the complexity of students' lives and their backgrounds was shocked me.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. You know, it shouldn't have shocked me, but, you know.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to me that some of it is this is such a good fit for my field, social work, that part of our values and ethics, our professional ethics, are that we're supposed to see oppression where it exists, and then we're supposed to act on it. So when we see how biased the grading system is and how it reinforces historical patterns of bias and all of the isms, my ethical obligation as a social worker to do something about that. And so to not do it, you know, and I think I pay attention to it because we talk about this a lot in the field and we talk about the inequity. Yet as the gentleman whose name I'm blanking on in episode 13.
Eiler, Josh Eiler.
As he was talking about, it's so interesting that we see these problems exist, but institutionally we don't do anything about them, not to make major change. To see this in social work and know this from a social work lens and not do something about it just seems wrong and unethical. The second piece of that, there's a big push in social work now to look at trauma-informed practice so that we try and understand people's trauma and look at people's experiences and their behavior through a trauma-informed lens. I think trauma is so involved in a lot of this and why people struggle and why there are mental health issues and why people are struggling in academia right now. Again, it feels unethical and hypocritical to me to be aware of this and to look at it through a trauma-informed lens and not to do anything different.
Right.
Or differently, as my English teacher mother would say.
It's good to have one of those. So I want to come back to that. I want to come back to this notion of that the field has responsibility here. If you see bias, the field it has to take action. So if I don't come back to this, I wrote a note. Remind me, we're going to come back and talk about that later. So how long have you been ungrading now? How many classes have you tried this in? Roughly how many students? Tell us about the parameters of that. Class sizes, are these all graduate classes? I know at least some of them are.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just teaching two classes a semester now. I've done this for two semesters. I did it last spring and I'm doing it this fall in both of my graduate classes. I'm only teaching one undergraduate class and it's already a pass-fail class, so not an option in there. And I don't think I will ever do grading again in any class that I teach. They've both been advanced master's level classes so far.
Okay. So let's talk about what your flavor of ungrading looked like, because it comes in lots of different, there's lots of flavors it can come in.
Yep.
What did you decide to do? How did you decide to approach this?
I did a couple of things. First, I had the students listen to the ungrading podcast and asked them to come in the first day and let's talk about it and talk about their experience with grades. So that was great to start a conversation. And I spent a lot of time talking to them about why I want to do this. Both from a student learning perspective, it's pretty clear to me that extrinsic motivations don't work particularly well. I teach a program development class and we talk about what motivates behavior change. And I've got a variety of research studies that I use in that class that show that intrinsic motivation works much better than extrinsic motivation. So I talk to them about that and about learning and where that can, where their motivation for learning can come from. And I talk about the bias issues built into our grading system. First of all, I have to say it created a fantastic conversation for the first day of class. It was a way for me to get to know them and them to get to know me a bit more. And to be able to tie that in again to social work values and ethics was very useful. And then I basically said to them that they were going to grade themselves over the course of the semester, that I was going to give them the same assignments I always do with a lot of written feedback, which I give, but no points attached to it. And at the end of the semester, they're going to write a couple of paragraphs to me talking about how much they learned in the class, how much effort they put into the class, how much effort they put into assignments, where they thought they did really well, where they think they could have done better, and then to give themselves a grade. And that I would honor their grades with two exceptions. If they didn't hand in work, I'm still playing with this and trying to learn how to do it, I think. But if they didn't hand things in, then I was going to grade them. And they're working in groups in both classes. And if they didn't show up for their groups, that I would grade them. So that was kind of the parameters I set on this.
I love that actually on day one. So day one, they come in, they've already listened to the podcast. So they did some pre-work coming in. So on day one, you really dove into this issue with them so explicitly. I mean, that was the whole intent of the first class, was to talk about that. I think that's very cool. I can't imagine what that discussion was like, but it must have been really interesting.
It was great.
Different than any way you've ever started a semester before.
Mm-hmm. You know, I usually talk about a variety of things in the first class. One of them is this idea, and I'm not sure if this is related here or not, but neutrality, that there is no such thing in my mind of neutrality. There's no neutral education and there's no neutral social work, that we're either supporting oppressive systems or we're actively working to end oppressive systems, and that grading isn't neutral and it can't be neutral because of the bias that's structurally built into our entire society. And so to go along with grading, it's reinforcing an oppressive system. So that led to a lot of interesting conversations about education as not neutral and how we are either, again, getting them to be change agents or getting them to be cogs in a wheel, and how grading fit with that and their experience with grading. And yeah.
Okay. So you were already headed down this road. You were having discussions on this topic already.
Yep.
This was just taking a huge step forward.
Yep.
Of how you're dealing with it. And how did they react? You said you had a great discussion. I mean, this is the first time they've ever been in class where they said, you're going to grade yourself.
Yeah. They were excited about it. And, you know, every time I offer a change, I've done a variety of things of trying to shake up class over the years. Students, there's always some number of students that are a little nervous about it. Are we going to have structure in here? Are we going to have assignments? Are things going to function like I'm used to? Just, you know, one piece I forgot from earlier, one of the other things I said to them is that I know that a lot of us place a lot of our self-esteem is based on grades that we get in classes. And so that I was wondering if it was going to be difficult for some students that I'm not reinforcing the A-ness of their lives. I also said to them, if anybody wanted me to grade them, I would. And that they didn't need to decide now. They could, you know, I've got their papers and I can keep an easy tally of points as we go along. I would be happy to give grades at the end of the semester if anybody wanted them to. So I think maybe that calmed them down a little. But I think in general, students were pretty excited about it from the beginning and, yeah, saw the potential of it being something beneficial for them and being different.
And how do they do on turning in assignments and attending group work? A couple of things you were monitoring.
I have to say I've been astonished in so many ways by this process. I was excited about it, and I was also a little nervous about it. I believe that most of us want to do well, and we want to do the right thing for intrinsic, not necessarily extrinsic reasons. And I wasn't sure that was true, so I was kind of curious what I was going to see, how this played out in class. I don't believe in taking attendance and penalizing people for missing class, because it feels like a grading thing to me. People's lives are so complicated. Just as an aside, our social work students, particularly our graduate students, but it's also true of our undergrads, tend to be older than a lot of traditional age college students. The majority of our students have kids. We've got lots of single parents. The vast majority of our students have to work in addition to full-time school, in addition to big unpaid internship hours that we require as a profession. And they're just swamped and they're overwhelmed. I don't penalize for attendance because I know how busy students' lives are, and I know that it's unequal responsibility. So they can't always get to class. And I found both last year and this semester that attendance was every bit as good as it is ever in my classes. Very few students tend to miss class. For the first 7 weeks of class, I didn't have a single person miss any classes this semester. I had a couple show up on Zoom with positive COVID tests and a positive strep test, and, you know, happily they were on Zoom. But everybody was there. And over the course of the semester, I had very few people miss any class. So even though they weren't getting graded, they were showing up. Every single person handed in every single assignment, both last year and this year. It wasn't a problem at all. Not only were they showing up for their groups, but I think they were doing better in their groups. I got feedback from a lot of students that a lot of them hate group work because their grade is dependent on somebody else's effort. I think groups are really important. I teach about community organizing and social policy advocacy, and those aren't things you can do on your own. You have to learn to work with other people. The resistance students have toward group work because of the grading piece really hurts their effort and hurts their learning. I heard repeatedly from students that these were the best group experiences they've ever had. They could work together. They could support each other. It was okay if somebody wasn't doing work up to somebody else's standards because they weren't getting graded on it. So they threw themselves into groups in a really healthy way. They showed up for each other. They were by far the best group experiences I've had in 30 years of teaching.
Whew, that's a big statement, because I was going to ask, how do you measure that compared to past experiences?
Well, I'll add one quick thing that's interesting to me, that I make them do group work in different classes for the reasons I stated, and sometimes I don't want to make them do group work because it's so much work. When groups start to fall apart, it's just a mess. And I had none of that last year or this year. For the first times probably ever, no groups fell apart. People were supportive of each other and kinder to each other. Yeah, it was great. It's made my life a lot better in addition to making students' lives better.
That's stunning. Because I assume every year, 10 or 15% of your groups you have issues with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, easily.
Some percentage, right?
Yeah.
So that's stunning. So for the first time ever in two semesters of group work, no problem.
Yeah, it was lovely. And can I go on a little theme there for a second? One of the other things.
Please
that was,
do.
Well, it was interesting to me. I would like to talk in a bit about how this feels like it's helped students' lives, because that's the reason I'm doing it. But it's also helped my life. One, again, not having the group mess that I deal with every semester has been lovely. Also, I try a lot of experimental things in my classes, and this is somewhat related to the grading piece too, that I want students to have as many opportunities as they can to show me that they're learning the material, because I think we all express that in different ways. I come up with ideas for different simulations we can do and different ways we can approach things, and they don't always work. When I do something in class that doesn't work and students are getting a grade, they get extremely upset, and I hear a lot from them because they're scared it's going to affect their grades. And even when I tell them it's not going to affect their grades, they get scared it's going to affect their grades. Both last semester and this semester, when things I tried didn't work, students were like, okay, no big deal. So I got less pushback from them. They were kinder to me because they could see that this was part of their learning and not part of how I'm going to judge them in a negative way. And the third thing that was better for me is I have gotten to the point after so many years of teaching, and I hear this from colleagues all the time, just hating grading. And I realize partly what I hate in grading is comparing the last paper I read with this paper of how many points do I take off? Is this an A or is it an A minus? Is it a B? I give a lot of feedback on papers, and to just give feedback and not worry about how it compared with somebody else's paper, not think about, okay, if I take 2 points off here, is somebody going to want to talk to me for 2 hours about why I took 2 points off? It's made grading a pleasure again. So that's been great.
So on your papers, did you get more interaction with students? Did they come and talk to you more about your comments on the paper so that they could go and improve the quality of the work?
Absolutely. One student wrote me feedback on the survey that I did that said she had not realized before that she was very defensive and closed off to feedback, because when the feedback was attached to a grade, it sounded like she was getting punished for not doing the work as well as she could have done. And getting feedback now instead, she felt like I was just supporting her learning and helping her think about different ways of doing this. So she was much more open to feedback. And she noted that she came in and talked to me and asked how she could revise it, which wasn't even a requirement. And I had a number of students revise work and hand it in to me that wasn't required, just so they could figure out if they actually got what it was I was looking for. And I've never had that happen before, by the way, when I've been giving grades.
Sorry, that's bouncing around in my head. So students turned in work. It could have been the final product. You handed it back with comments with your red ink or whatever color you choose to use of the day. They might come and talk to you about it. And then some of them worked on it and wrote it and improved the paper in a situation where they didn't have to.
Yeah, I was a little stunned.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, related to that, I actually thought students, even though I tried this and believed in it, I wasn't sure that students would try as hard as they had when I was giving them a grade. And that hasn't been my experience at all. One of the interesting things to me is I had probably 40% of students, maybe 50% of students, hand in drafts of papers before they submitted them. I think that's higher than normal in a class. And I talked to them about it of, you know, you're not getting a grade. Why are you doing this? And they said, we want to make sure we're getting it, that they wanted to make sure that they were learning. So it was really exciting to me that they cared enough to want to get feedback before it was due, even though they weren't getting graded on it.
So they wanted to make sure that they were learning what you wanted them to get out of these, out of this work. Is that unusual? You know, 2 years ago, were students coming, or let's go to pre-COVID, sometime three, four years ago, were students coming to you and doing the same thing, saying, hey, I really want to make sure I learn this? Or is this an unusual comment?
The comment is unusual. Some students handed in drafts. I'm always happy to read drafts. And they handed in drafts before the things were due. I think the numbers are higher now than they used to be, which surprised me. Mm-hmm. But I also, students in the past would say, I want to make sure this is what you want. I really want an A. It really was very grade focused. And now it's really much more, I want to know if I'm doing this right, because it's important that I learn it.
Wow. Wow. You wanted to talk about how this helps students. So let's sort of turn the tables now and talk about that, because it sounds like one of the ways, at least it appears to you that it has helped students, is that they're no longer focusing on their grade. Here's this work, here's the grade, as opposed to now it's, here's the work. Am I learning what I need to learn here?
Yeah. You know, a lot, it's interesting in our field because they're going to be going out and practice what they're learning. And I'm hearing from a lot of them, I want to be the best social worker that I can be. And I do think that's been a shift, that it's not, I want to get this grade, but that I actually want to learn this material so that I can go out and do it well in the field. Both verbal comments and written comments I got from students were around a number of themes. Almost every student said that it reduced their stress, which I think is great. And quite a few of them said when they were less stressed, they were more able to learn effectively. And I think we know that from particularly the psychology literature, that a little bit of stress is helpful and a lot of stress is very detrimental. I mentioned earlier, our students are stressed beyond belief. I can't even figure out how most of them get up and manage their days when I hear about their lives. The added pressure and the added stress of grading just seems to make that worse and makes them unable to take in much in terms of learning. So a lot of them said they were less stressed and they were more open to learning. The feedback I got both last year and this year also was that they were more willing to take risks. A number of students told me that on their papers and projects, they frequently did the same topic over and over again because they already had a basic lit review that they've done for another class and they didn't have to redo the work. And I heard from quite a few students that they were doing things they were really interested in that were new that they haven't done before because they knew the grade didn't matter, so they were willing to delve into the learning in a very different way. So I thought that was exciting. I also found when I do classroom activities where they have to come up and role play or do other things in class, students are more willing to do it, again, because it's not getting graded. I just keep reinforcing it's about learning and they get that. Yeah, I think I mentioned this earlier and I'll say it again because it was such a big deal for me. A number of students told me that when they see feedback now that I give them in a very different way, that to them, a lower grade or missed points felt like a punishment for something they weren't doing right. And now feedback feels like I'm just urging them to learn more. So they hear it in a very different way and they seem much more open to it.
Yeah, so it really is constructive criticism, not just criticism.
Yeah.
And a grade, of course, as everybody's experienced, the minute students see a grade, that's the end of it. They see a grade, they throw the paper in the back of the car, or in the back seat, or wherever they put it, and they never think about it again, as opposed to, here's comments, there's no grade, and what I'm hearing from you is that students are really taking that to heart and either continuing to work or at least being open to the commentary, the comments that you've made, and really in a more thoughtful and thought-provoking way for them.
Yes.
Deeper learning.
Yeah. And I will say that it reminds me a little bit. When I first started teaching, I had a colleague in Arizona who said to me, don't ever give a student an 89. If you're going to give them a grade, give them an 88. Because if you give them an 89, it's 1 point and they're going to come in and badger you to give them an extra point. And it struck me then about how ridiculous grades are. Because if that's what's shaping my grading decision, and it was, honestly, I listened to that and I took it to heart because I get so tired of arguing with students over a point. I didn't care what grade they were getting. A point was ludicrous to me. Now, if they're coming in talking, it's because, you know, you said that I didn't get this quite right. What would quite right look like? So that we can have a conversation about what is it that I need to know to do this better?
Yeah. Okay, I got to make some notes here. Things to talk about. Hang on. Okay, so you've done surveys in these classes, and you've talked about some of the results of those surveys. What else came out of those surveys that you found interesting, particularly, you know, compared to prior years? It's not like you're a new teacher.
No.
You have lots of experience.
I'm an old teacher.
I didn't mean that.
I feel it. It's all right. So I sent out a survey to my class, and I want to talk a little bit more about it later, but the faculty asked me to come in and talk to them about ungrading this year, and a number of other faculty are doing this, and so a couple others did surveys in there. They use my survey in their classes as well.
Oh.
Yeah, so we're trying to get some data to share with other faculty about what's working and what's not working.
Mm-hmm.
I asked the students the following: how much did they learn in the class compared to other classes? How much of the reading did they do compared to other classes? How much effort did they put into assignments compared to other classes? How much effort did they put in the class overall compared to other classes? Did the fact that the class was ungraded contribute to their learning in any way? And if so, explain how. Did the fact that the class was ungraded hinder their learning in any way? And if so, explain how. And then given the choice of taking a class graded or ungraded, which would they choose and explain why? And I will say 100% said to me, I heard back from everybody except one student.
Okay, so let's just start right there.
Yeah.
You heard back from everybody but one student. Okay, that never happens on surveys.
No, it was shocking to me. And they said to me that they are now my ambassadors for ungrading. I know they've been speaking to other faculty about it. They're very excited about it.
The revolution begins.
We hope so. I've been trying.
At Chico State, anyway.
60-some-odd years to get the revolution going, so I'm hopeful. So 100% of them said that they learned more or as much in this class compared to the other classes. 100% said they put in as much effort into the class and into assignments, and 100% said they put in as much or more. They did as much or more of the reading as they did in other classes.
How many students are we talking?
Oh, I had 20 in this class. So pretty small.
So is that 20 each semester?
Yeah. I had 22 last spring and 20 this semester.
Okay, so we got 42 taking this survey?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so the N is not 10 and
no.
It's not 500, but
right.
Okay.
Yeah. So 100% of them said they would choose ungraded over graded, which was lovely. And again, you know, just a quote from one of them. I was concerned about what I was learning and not about the grade. The learning was enough to keep me engaged. So I heard a lot of comments like that. A lot of them mentioned that that they took risks they wouldn't normally take. One person said to not worry about my grade was freeing. I was able to learn and be creative with assignments in a way that I wouldn't have had it been graded. And the creativity paid off and we had a really great final assignment. A lot of my classes this semester was on legislative advocacy and social welfare policy, and they had to make a commercial at the end of the class. They had a variety of things, choices they could do.
Mm-hmm.
Most of this class chose commercials, and they were amazing. Some of the highest quality I've ever seen. And I know not all of that is ungrading. Some of it's the technology that's available now that they can use to figure out how to do these things. But they all got it in just a really, just a beautiful way. Their end products were really, really lovely. So that was great.
Interesting.
You know, somebody else said, I didn't feel as much stress or pressure when completing assignments, and I felt more confident in writing what I thought instead of what I thought I was supposed to think or say. And I heard that a lot from students, that they think faculty have certain expectations of what should come in that stifles their being thoughtful or creative. And without the grade there, they really were more creative and they explored their own take on the material and what it is they wanted to say in really new and interesting ways.
Now, of course, you don't have the survey from your class from 4 years ago. So, so maybe all your students would say this about you. Maybe this is just you. I mean, how much of this is you versus ungrading, do you think?
It's such an interesting question. I think it's both. I get feedback from students that's similar to some of this sometimes. And as I tried to change grading and make it fair for them, I also heard from them that that was reducing stress, but not to the level that I'm hearing it now.
Okay. So the volume's been turned up.
A lot. And I also really think the quality of their work was as good as I've ever seen from these students. And this is a class I have taught at least 30 times, probably more. So I have a fair amount of history in terms of what I expect from this class. Mm-hmm. And, you know, different groups of students do better and worse over the years. And I think a lot of this, both last year and this year, is really just reinforced for me that the students can do really good quality work without the bludgeon threat of a grade hanging over their heads.
Yeah. So let's talk about grades. So at the end of the semester, they wrote a few paragraphs for you and they proposed a grade that they would like to receive for the course.
They did. And mostly that was great. I am having a little bit of struggle with this, and I'll tell you where some of my struggle, the biggest struggle with this is coming in for me right now. I think there's a fair amount of research out there, and I have a lot of experience out there that particularly gender, but I think there's other factors as well, come into play about how we speak about ourselves and think about ourselves.
Sure.
I have found over the years that men are much more willing to say, I did a great job, I'm a rock star on this. And that women are like, you know, I did okay, I kind of did my best. And I was worried about that in terms of the grading piece. And I have seen that piece come through. So for example, I had one woman this year who I thought did a great job in the class, had a lot of outside life pressure and missed a couple of class sessions, but she was on Zoom when she could be. And her work was excellent all semester, and she gave herself a B because she didn't do as well as she thought she could have done. I couldn't give her a B because I don't think she deserved a B. I think she did better work than some other students, and I feel like she learned more and put more effort in. So how that societal bias still comes through in terms of them grading themselves feels very difficult to me. I actually talked to students about that at the beginning of the year, that how we think about ourselves is not an individual issue. It's how we've been taught to think about ourselves in a society where there's racial and gender and other bias. I wanted them to think about how they talk about themselves. So she was one example of somebody who graded herself lower than I thought she deserved. I had two men this semester, one who gave himself an A+, which I had not seen before, and the other who said his work was truly outstanding. And they both might have been true, but it's not something any of the women, I don't think, would have said. So even just from a gender perspective, and I think race comes in there and class comes in there, so that was really difficult for me, and it's still feeling difficult for me. And what I decided to do is just give them all A's. I think they worked hard and they deserved it, and they all made a case for learning. And I will say it's also different a little bit at the graduate level. You know, 70% of our grad students get A's anyway, and the others maybe get an A- or a periodic B. So it's not much of a shift from how I would have graded before this.
Yeah.
And that's something I would love to talk to other people about and read more about, how people get past that issue of self-grading and the bias that's built into that.
Yeah, it's a graduate class, so the grades are different and less, and in many ways, as we know, so much less important.
Yeah, they don't matter at all. They're not going to grad school. The few that are going to go on and get a PhD, I have been on PhD admission committees before. We don't even look at master's grades because they're so similar. There's so little variability that they're not useful. We look at undergrad grades. So the grades that I give them truly make no difference to anybody for any reason.
Well, that's sort of nice too.
Yeah.
It takes the pressure off you.
Yeah.
Right. But in spite of that, you said earlier, you talked about the thing you hate about your job most is the grading. Of course, you do teach undergrads as well. So it's more of a role there, but grading is a stress for you.
Yep.
So you've done this in a modest size graduate course. You've got an undergraduate course that you teach. Are you thinking about taking ungrading to the undergraduate level?
I absolutely would. The course I'm teaching is a field seminar course, and it's all pass-fail.
So I can't do it in there.
I'm hoping in the future to go back to teaching some other undergrad courses and larger undergrad courses, and 100% would do this. I can't fathom now that I know what I know to ever going back and giving grades again, because I don't think, you know, I know there's a lot of conversation out there about reducing or getting rid of bias in grading, and I'm not sure it's possible. I don't know how to do it yet, and I can't figure out how to do it. And when I know that what I'm doing is reinforcing the bias, even teaching a large undergrad class, I can't fathom going back to giving grades.
All right. So how large a class could you imagine that you could do this in a, you know, equitably?
Any.
So you could 100, 150, you'd be comfortable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where it gets a little more challenging for me with that is spending the time connecting with students about the grade they're giving themselves, because you have less time in bigger classes. So it's reading through all the things. It feels more complicated to me. You know, now if my students, like the student that gave herself a B, I had a conversation with her about, I don't know about this, and this doesn't seem right to me. That feels much harder when you have 150 students in a class that you're trying to manage that with. So I think it would take a lot more thought on my part about how to do that well and how to do it fairly.
Mm-hmm. So you'd have to think about assignments, class structure, assignment structure, really, about how do you grade and how do you provide evaluations and assessments.
Yep.
Evaluations, right? Evaluations.
Yeah.
Because you're providing evaluation information for them all the time.
Yep.
Right? You're not assessing them in terms of providing a score. Interesting. So class size doesn't scare you. It's just a problem that you'd have to figure out how to solve.
Yes, and it's a theoretical problem right now. So if it was a it's happening tomorrow problem, I don't know if I would think about it in the same way. I would hope I would.
Okay. But you would make every effort to do it.
I would.
Because the ethical aspects of it don't allow you to provide grades anymore, essentially.
Yep. That's the challenge.
Interesting. Okay, so which way should we take this? So let's talk about your department then, because you raised the issue. You said, oh, your department, they sounds like they used the same survey you used in some number of classes.
A couple.
So that you had some not controlled data, but some comparative data.
Yep.
And it sounds like you have departmental interests. So let's talk about both of those things.
Well, first I would say that students in my class went and talked to lots of other faculty about, Sue's not giving us grades, why are you giving us grades? And she said that it's a justice issue, and you say you believe in justice. Our students like to advocate for themselves.
Okay.
So how can you still give grades when it's not just? So my faculty members wanted to chat with me about that. Some because they were irritated, and some because they were interested. And they asked me to come talk to a faculty in a faculty meeting about this process. So I shared the podcast on ungrading and other material that I had found online and asked people to look over it before I came in. And we had a good half hour, 45 minute conversation about it and what's working and where it's challenging. Faculty had a lot of questions, which we discussed. And after that, I think there are four of us this semester that I know of in the department. We're a fairly small department that are trying ungrading in classes. I've had a number of faculty reach out to me, including one who just reached out to me. I'm meeting with her tomorrow morning to talk about it and talk about how it worked and what the challenges were and how they can approach it. We had a lot of conversation. Is this something that we would want to take on as a department and everybody do this? There were mixed feelings about that. Or is it something that people want to try a little at a time? I know of at least three other colleagues that in the spring are not going to be doing grading and are going to try this process. So I think it's spreading in the department as something that makes sense to faculty and something that people want to try.
That's amazing. So three faculty in addition to you. So you'll be four next semester.
Let's see. There's three of us are doing it this semester. And I think there's currently, and I think there's four more people that want to try it next semester. So I think there'll be seven of us in the department that are at least that I know of that are giving this a try.
What's the size of your department, roughly?
I think we have 10 tenure track faculty and a bunch more adjunct faculty. I'm not sure how many.
So next semester, you've got seven or eight faculty that are going to be trying, that are going to be implementing ungrading in their courses. Are these seven or eight, are any of them adjunct?
Two that I know of.
So that's amazing, right? Right there. A lot of people, I think, will be surprised by that, that adjuncts feel secure enough in their position that they can do that, right? Because a lot of adjuncts are in places where that's probably not possible. Of course, let's note that Chico is fairly remote. It's 90 minutes from Sacramento. I used to be at Chico State. You don't have a lot of freeway flyers there who are teaching. I mean, some might be teaching at Yuba or at some of the community colleges around.
Correct.
Their jobs, at least in my experience there, and I don't know about social work, we have a lot of long-standing adjunct faculty. And they actually have protection if they've been there long enough. They have union protection for their rights as well.
Yep. And, you know, we really had an interesting conversation about, will the department be supportive of this if people do it, or will they punish people for doing this? And we had that conversation around tenure, because I raised the issue that some untenured faculty might not feel comfortable about it, and around part-time faculty. Are people safe if they do this? Is it something that we are open to or actively support as a department? And I think there was a lot of very supportive conversation that this is something that we think is a good idea. It's something we want to continue to explore, and nobody will be punished for doing it. And I don't know that that will be true in all departments. And I think it is true and was believed in our department.
Nice. So the leadership of the department is supportive.
Yes. Yep.
That's nice. We're not going to talk about the dean level issues there, about whether or not the dean is supportive. Don't say anything. I don't want to know. We're not going to go down that road.
Yep.
But that would be an issue. That might be an issue for tenure for some people. But with strong departmental support, that's really great to hear.
Yes, and I'll throw out one other thing that we did talk about that was interesting to me, that nobody knows what grades anybody gives anybody outside of the department level. So there's no reason the dean's level or levels above that would know that somebody did ungrading if they don't raise it. So as long as the department knows about it and doesn't care, we couldn't see any risk going to the upper levels at the university.
Oh, that's interesting. So institutionally, there are institutional data looking at, and I know this for undergraduate grades at Chico State, people are looking at all sorts of data that do relate to grades in particular classes. So, of course, the most obvious are gateway courses. Don't like that term, but, you know, gateway courses. You know, how many Ds, Fs, and withdrawals does a faculty member have, and how is that distributed among the class diversity, right, the diversity of students? And we know that there's another injustice and another inequity that we know, and lots of people are working on. So grades are looked at, but that is interesting that in tenure decisions, right, grades aren't seen.
And it's interesting for us because social work departments across the country have been accused of grade inflation often, that we don't grade like they do in the hard sciences. So for social workers, it's not unusual for social work classes to give all A's or most A's, as I said, for sure at the graduate department, but also at graduate level, but also at the undergraduate level. So I think for us, there might be a little less pressure or a little less discomfort in terms of a lot of the students are getting A's. And I think that's somewhat discipline specific.
So that's interesting then in terms of grade distribution. If students are all getting A's and B's in most undergraduate courses, let's just say if students are getting A's and B's in undergraduate social work courses, then ungrading, the values of ungrading really have less to do with the actual grade that's assigned than the psychological impact on both the faculty, because it's still stressful, and on the students. It really has very little to do with the end product of what they get, of the grade that is assigned. Because in all these cases, well, in these cases we're talking about, grades are still assigned at the end of the day.
Correct.
This isn't Evergreen State, where they have evaluations at the end of the day, which is the extreme end of this spectrum. And it would be great if we could all do that, but that's not where we're going. At the end of the day, you're still providing a grade.
Yep.
Interesting.
And we actually had a little bit of a conversation in the faculty meeting of, could we move to a place that we don't do that as a faculty? Could we move more or all of our classes into a pass-fail scenario? And I don't know whether that will go anywhere, and I'm not sure what that conversation, and you know, there's pros and cons to doing that as well. But at least got people thinking about, if the grades are problematic, is there a way we can get rid of them altogether as a department?
And so let's talk about professional schools. So how would the loss of grades, if you got rid of grading, how would that affect you? What if students applied to your social work program and had no grades? How would that affect your assessment and your, you know, how you select students?
It would certainly make it more difficult. And that's one of the things that I think we were talking about, as most, well, from what I've been hearing, lots and lots and lots of faculties across the country are understaffed and overworked. And so the admission process, and you know, we hear this about law schools and med schools and other things, that the easiest thing to assess are grades and test scores, because they're objective, they're in front of you, though they aren't, they look fair and easy. For us to have to go through and read evaluations of students and kind of translate that would be a big workload issue for us in terms of admissions. So that's one of the concerns that people raised. I don't know how to get around that one, actually. And the flip side of that is grades are not a good predictor of how people are going to do in grad school, the same way test scores are not a good predictor. And they're certainly not a good predictor of how social workers are going to do in the field. I have students that have really struggled academically that I see in the field, and they are just rock star social workers. So the two don't seem very highly correlated to me. So I think it's time that we start thinking about how do we look at other things in terms of who gets into our graduate program. And I don't know what those things would be, and I don't know how do we get there in a way that is not going to be a huge hit on workload for the people that have to do this. So I have no answers to that one.
Okay, so currently students are admitted based on grades and essays and...
Yeah, grades is a piece of it. Essays, work experience, we take a lot of things into consideration there.
Yeah. If it's only a piece of it, what if you just drop grades and you were just left with whatever else you have?
Really interesting idea, and something I would certainly raise with the faculty and have a conversation about.
I mean, if you already know that grades are useless.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one piece that's the interesting problem then, too, of what about our undergraduate students if they're applying to schools other than ours that still are looking at grades? Is that going to hurt them in terms of getting in elsewhere? And my gut reaction to that is no, because as you stated, Evergreen, Hampshire College, other places don't give grades, and their students seem to do fine getting into professional schools or graduate programs. So I don't know what impact it would have.
Yeah, and I don't know. When students send transcripts from Evergreen or Hampshire College, I don't know all the schools nationally that do this. What do they send? Do they translate? Does the administration translate the evaluation to a grade? Do they just send evaluations? I don't know how that works. I need to find that out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I do know that for international students, the international office on campus goes through and assigns grades. So somebody is actually doing that. I would assume that the same is true for students that come in from ungraded schools, that somebody evaluates them. And I don't think it's been us. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming somebody in some other grad studies or somewhere else does that. I don't know, though. It's a great question.
Some black box somewhere.
Yep.
Yep. Let me see. So
can I read you another quote?
Oh, I'd love to hear it. Yeah. Read me your three favorite quotes or whatever number you have there you want to read.
So somebody in the question about, did the fact that the class was ungraded contribute to their learning in any way? One person wrote, I put more effort into this class because I felt a sense of pride and ownership in my educational goals. The workload was equally challenging, and reading was also equally distributed like all the other courses. The only difference was that I felt more invested because it was a different level of responsibility and a healthy stress level. I found myself more accepting of the mistakes I made and reached out to you to explore alternative ways to problem solve, which I think was lovely and pretty much summed up the experience that I think a lot of different students had.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I think we're going to put that on the webpage. I think we'll quote that student on the webpage anonymously, of course.
I like it. I'll read you one more that I liked. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy how ungrading puts the focus on learning and takes away that pressure to try and be perfect. It also lets us dive deeper into what we are learning about instead of stressing over getting enough points on assignments to pass the class. So I think those really kind of summed up people's experiences with this.
Yeah, sounds like they're doing what people talk about it, right? Which is it takes students' minds off the grades and they focus on learning and they become more invested. And I love the comment about ownership. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, if you become invested, that's ownership.
Yep.
And that's what we want. We want students who invest in their own learning, who own it, who become responsible for their own learning, because we can't just do a brain dump from you to them. It doesn't work that way.
It does not.
Yeah. Okay, Sue, I think, I'm not ready to end. So I usually ask, as you've heard at the end of episodes, about some transformational moment. Are there some transformational moments in your career that have guided you in the direction you've gone?
I think I have a slightly different answer, that I have always loved teaching and learning. I grew up in a family of academics, high school teacher and then a community college teacher. Hmm. My sister's a teacher. And my brother has done various things, but in also teaching. I have such a passion for learning and education and teaching. A lot of students come into social work programs from groups that have been traditionally disadvantaged and oppressed in society, and I watch how incredibly much they've struggled with our education system that was developed by and for wealthy white men, and nobody else was allowed in. And we haven't changed the system very much since it was developed for wealthy white men. And it isn't a system that works for so many of the students that come through our programs. And watching how they struggle and how committed they are to their education in spite of the tremendous barriers that we place in front of them all the time really, really affected me to wanting to figure out how can I be the most equitable, fair, decent faculty member that I can be in this setting, given that I know how broken the setting is and how it wasn't designed to work for them or to make them successful. How can I change what I do in a way to be able to make them successful? So that's one piece. And I will give a second piece that was very transformational to me. When I was at Arizona State, we had a distance program that we taught up at Flagstaff. 70-80% of our students were indigenous students from the Hopi and the Navajo tribes. Before that, I had one or two indigenous students in class. Their voices were completely overshadowed by other students. The first time I went to teach up there and I presented what I was planning on doing for the class, because they were in a rare moment in their lives, the majority in the room, I got a lot of pushback about this doesn't work for us. It doesn't work culturally for us. It doesn't work educationally for us. So I stopped and said, what does work? What can we do with the assignments? What can we do with the class? What can we do with how I approach the material that fits better for you? I learned so much in the 5-6 years I taught up there from students up there that really reminded me of my cultural bias that was so ever present in my teaching that I didn't notice. And that we get pushback from one or two students and we write it off as, you know, this is a discontented student for some reason. But when it was in my face that it was the majority of students in class and they really took time to explain to me how education has never worked for them culturally, it really kicked me to start to think about who's in my class and how do I need to think about doing things in such a different way to meet the really wide-ranging needs of students that are there that the system wasn't ever built to support or to encourage towards success.
So that experience must have then impacted your work back at the main campus. So that must have changed how you approach your classes there as well.
Yep. It's changed everything I do about my teaching in the years that have followed.
That's a transformational moment.
And I know I still have a long way to go with it. I still continue to learn from every class that I teach. I do things and they're like, nope. And I'm like, okay, you're absolutely right. That's a big nope and I shouldn't be doing it. And how can I think about this differently? And, you know, I used to be pretty hard on myself about it and I'm not anymore because I can only look through the lens that I have. And I can be open and make my classes safe enough and comfortable enough that students can say to me, this isn't working for us. And that they can see that I'm going to honor their voices and make changes. So I think I try very hard to do that.
So then let me back up and ask then why social work? Why did you end up in social work? And was that where you were always headed?
From the time I was little, that's where I was headed. I wanted to drive a garbage truck when I was very little. But when I got over that piece, social work felt like somewhat because of my upbringing, my parents had me involved in social change things from the time I was little. My mom had me knocking on doors for elections when I was 8.
Okay.
And so there was always a push to make things different. I went into the macro side of social work, which is about community change and policy change. Yeah, I never really had a choice about that. It always felt like the direction that I needed to go.
Yeah, that was home for you. At home and your home.
Yep.
It just became the comfortable place.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's great. Sue, I think we're gonna call it right there. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I'll say at this point, it's pretty clear we're friends, but we've known each other for some number of years, and I always enjoy our conversations.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. I'm so excited about this topic, and I'm excited that your podcast led me down a road that finally makes me feel like I'm doing the equitable job I should be doing around grading in the classroom. So I'm excited to talk about it.
Well, nice. And thank you so much for that, because that's why I do this podcast. So it makes me feel just like this is a good thing to do. So I'm happy. Right. It's wonderful. So for more information about Dr. Steiner, her research, favorite books and papers, please go to our website, teachingforstudentsuccess.org. Thank you for spending time with us today. Please share our podcast and website with your friends, colleagues, and administrators. We love hearing from our listeners. Please contact us through our website. If an episode has impacted your teaching, please send us a note and let us know what impacted you, what you've done in your classroom, and how it's impacted your students. Teaching for Student Success is a production of Teaching for Student Success Media. Let's end this podcast, as I always do, with some music of Julius H. Some of Julius's music can be found on Pixabay.